Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Last weekend, I moderated a panel at Everyman Theater in Baltimore. It's part of the World of the Play series that centered around finding a voice. The conversation was inspired by the play Tribes, Everyman's current performance, and we looked at ways we communicate. Enjoy.
Welcome. Good to have you all with us. Out of the work of Tribes, the play that most of you have seen, I think, comes a lot of questions about the divide among us, and not just deaf and hearing, but how that in many ways represents divides between many people in our society and kind of profoundly represents that. Much like race represents that divide as well, this is a very different and special way of thinking about it. So we're lucky to have this panel. At the far end is Kara A. Miller.
Hello, everyone.
I spent the afternoon reading some of the interviews she's done. She's Resource Center Coordinator at Gallaudet, and she has her PhD, a doctoral study in clinical psychology for Gallaudet, and I read a really fascinating interview with her about that thesis, so I was really looking forward to doing this. Next to her is Tim McCarty, who is a long-standing person in our theater world. He's Artistic Director of Quest Visual Theater, and he works at Gallaudet as well, and has performed with their performing arts program across the globe in doing visual theater, which we'll be exploring some in this conversation. Just incredible work. And Will Connolly is next to me. He is the Interim Program Director of Theater and Dance at Gallaudet and the Director of Artistic Sign Language here at Everyman Theater. And if you've been to the production, you've seen the intensity and change that's taken place because of this production that will now be permanent in this theater, which is really, I think, amazing and important to have been done. So without further ado, you can read the lengthy bios in this. I'll let you do that on your own. So welcome, everyone. So we have people here who are signing, and in the audience as well. So that means everything we do will take a tad longer than we usually do because of the way we're going to do this. This is being recorded visually. They're back. So for the web, and we're also recording it for the radio, and we'll be transcribing this entire thing for the web as well, so it'll all be there. So welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So let me begin by asking the question that comes out of the movie. Out of the play, Tribes. And this was, I think, for many in this audience, in most theater audiences, their first experience watching deaf actors and being involved in the complexity of a play between deaf people and hearing people. I'm just curious... I know that when you work in deaf theater, which we'll get to in a moment, theater of the deaf in a moment, but what's the significance of this and of this play and of plays like this for audiences and for audiences hearing and deaf?
This is Tim responding. Well, it's tough. For a deaf actor or actress in this business, they have to look around for shows that have deaf characters in them, or they have to find a creative director who would consider casting a deaf actor in a non-deaf role. I remember that once upon a time I coordinated a national forum on theater arts and disability at the Kennedy Center, and I asked the actress Phyllis Frelick to give the keynote address. about careers in the arts. Phyllis, just FYI, had won a Tony for her role in Children of a Lesser God. And normally once you win an award like that, you're a hot ticket. People cast you in their shows, that your fees go up, and so on and so forth. But Phyllis really got no offers after that role and after winning that Tony. And her first sentence at the Kennedy Center as part of her keynote was, "Tim McCarty asked me to give you a keynote address about careers in the arts." And I said to him, and I say to you, what career? So it can be tough. But having said that, when these things come together, it's magical. It brings a new energy to the theater and to the deaf community as well as audience members and as patrons. And we feel that buzz with the production here in Baltimore.
Kara, please go ahead.
So I've been the fortunate recipient of the opportunity to be involved with theater really my entire life as a deaf child. I was born deaf. I was raised in a mainstream, i.e. hearing environment. And as a high school student, I got involved in a theater company called Imagination Stage. It was known as the Deaf Access Company back in those days, but now it's Imagination Stage. And it brought together and brings together hearing, deaf, and children whose parents are deaf, although they themselves are hearing, known as CODAs, to bring together to do these theater workshops. And so that's, had it not been for that opportunity, and of course that opportunity would have been impossible without actors such as Phyllis paving the way.
This is Willie. I'm wondering, please, if you wouldn't mind repeating your question.
Oh, sure. The question, in short, was the significance of having a play like this with deaf actors and hearing actors. Most of the audiences have never seen work by deaf actors. What that means for both the actors in the theater and the audience. And the significance of it, because I think, well, I'm thinking about your work specifically now. What you did in this particular production can help change the face of theater in the city here. I think this is a significant production and what's come out of it.
This is Willie responding. I think a production like this really gives the audience some awareness about deaf culture, deaf cultural issues. It helps them see deaf people as normal folk, just like themselves. I think there are still a lot of people out there who see deaf people as less than or as second-class citizens. And that issue is addressed in the play. The character whose name escapes me at the moment.
Billy.
Billy. Oh, my goodness. The character of Billy, who is deaf, complains to his parents that they see him as a second-class citizen. And I think that it's important for an audience to come see a deaf actor on stage saying that. It gives them, I think, a different outlook, and it improves our standing in the greater social fabric. So seeing a deaf actor on stage, now, I've worked with hearing actors who are equity, who've been, you know, part of the theater world for a long time, but this gives them the opportunity to work with a deaf actor who's also an equity actor. And that opportunity is rare, but it, I think, raises everybody up in the way that a rising boat or a rising tide floats all boats.
And this is Tim. I think what drives us crazy is that sometimes we feel like we take, you know, two steps back for every step forward that we've done. So a couple of years ago in Baltimore, there was a production of The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. And it had a deaf character in the show. And the producers never auditioned any deaf actors for that role and felt no responsibility to do so. So, of course, there was a hue and cry from the deaf community. And shortly thereafter, the production of Miracle Worker was put on here in Baltimore. And the role of Helen Keller was not played by a deaf blind actress. The performance was in New York. So both of those productions were in New York. And there was an article in the New York Times about it. And, you know, talking about the argument and sort of all the views brought to bear. But the Times also has a blog. And there were over 200 comments on that blog page. You remember, Willie. You know, no one knows who you are online, right? Nobody knows anybody's identity. And you can see some really strong feelings. People saying, I was in a show with a deaf actor and they didn't know if they bumped into a prop. They didn't know when to come in. And, you know, this is Broadway and we're going to be paying, you know, I'm paying $150 for a ticket. I want to see the best of the best. So, of course, you shouldn't be hiring deaf actors. So those kinds of comments were on this blog. And here at Everyman, we've felt very welcomed. And in Baltimore in general, I would say there's a welcoming community. But when you read something like that, it's so striking.
So, This is taking the conversation a different way, but I like this. As you were describing, it made me think about what happens in roles that are played by people of color. Let's say you have a Native American role, and they're always played by somebody white, like Johnny Depp. but I'm 1/8 Cherokee, and we also have the issue now of colorblind casting that has been raised in theater, and important, I think, really important. So I think what you all are raising right now is a new frontier for many people, not for deaf people, but for many people in theater. So this is opening a discussion that we don't often have about what it means for deaf actors, let's say, to work in productions and not necessarily as a deaf character, or when there is a deaf character, to ensure there is a deaf actor in that role.
This is Kara. The reason why I mentioned my previous involvement at Imagination Stage is that was an example of, I guess, what you would call colorblind casting. It didn't matter if the actors were hearing or deaf or hard of hearing. It was just about casting people in a role, and then we would figure out how we would express the ideas from the playwright to the audience. So there were no preconceived notions about this character needs to be X, Y, or Z, and therefore the actor, you know, is going to be hired who's going to fit those parameters. They sort of figured out who was going to be best for the part, and then we dialogued about how to make it work. So it was very innovative techniques that were being used.
This is Willie. I love it when theater directors are open-minded about characters in a script, in a play. Maybe the author has not, or the playwright has not specified that the character is deaf, but an open-minded director might see an opportunity there. I have worked from time to time with Center Stage, I am an associate artist with them and have been for the last decade or so. And you might be familiar with Irene Lewis, the artistic director there, who cast me in The Hostage, a play called The Hostage. The character is a volunteer in the IRA. And that person is always with, in the company of, another IRA person. So even though I was on stage a lot, the artistic director thought to have the confidence in me to put me on stage. So it just really relies on people with an open mind to make those kinds of casting decisions to give people opportunities.
And this is Willie, and this is Tim, the willingness to pay for it. It's not that inexpensive. And so I, again, want to applaud Everyman Theater. You know, we have three interpreters working with us tonight at this panel. We've had interpreters at the rehearsals for this production, and that does cost money. So you have to be a visionary, you have to be brave, willing to take a risk, and willing to put your money where your mouth is.
Hi, Kara.
And this is Kara. Another issue I would like to bring up is, you know, as we see in the play of Tribes, we're no longer confining deaf characters to one kind of portrayal. So, you know, for example, Billy uses his voice. I mean, in the past, if you talked about a deaf character, it would be somebody who would be on stage not speaking. They would only be signing, and it would only be a certain kind of signing. So really, there's so much variety in the deaf community. And Billy is one example of the kind of variety that's in our community. And I'm thrilled to see that because I am somebody who is deaf. I use sign language, but I also speak and I use my voice when I want it, depending on what the situation is.
This is Tim. I also like that Billy, the character of Billy, is flawed. I think frequently in literature, a character with a disability has some kind of magical power, a gift of some sort. But in this play, Billy's a normal bloke. He's a human with issues. That whole problem with him about lip reading for the courts is a prime example of that. I love that. This is Willie. I like that too, and I'm glad that Kara raised this issue because it's important to show range, not only with sign, but it's important to show the variation within the community from lip reading to sign to other kinds of communication. So I really do applaud John McGinty, the actor in that role, for taking on the role. I have worked with a lot of deaf students at Gallaudet University, teaching them about the art of acting, Acting 101, for example, and you know, I tell them that sometimes you might be cast in a role that calls for you to use your voice. So we do some vocal exercises from time to time, and that's just kind of part and parcel. I don't feel, you know, compelled to force people to do that, but I do let them know that there's some roles out there that might require both modes from them. And so I want them to have the ability to do that. And we talk about whether, you know, they'd be interested in taking on a role like that or not.
This is Tim. I remember going to Northwestern University summer program, and they had, you know, basically a speech class, and people, you know, were upset about it. Why should I have to take a speech class? And then some end up loving it, and they end up, you know, training others. So it was not so much about the speech, but it was about the breathing technique. So, you know, it was other kinds of exercises, but being open to that, to working the entire instrument, whatever tools you have, whatever tools you have, baby.
Willie, exactly.
And this is Kara. Several summers ago, I had the opportunity and privilege, really, to be involved in Deaf West Theater Summer School for Actors. And they brought in all sorts of instructors. We had Gary Austin from The Groundlings. And he insisted that we do a musical. And here we are, a group of deaf actors, just sort of puzzled. You know, you want us to sing, like, on stage and sing and... I've been told my whole life that my voice is not, you know, appropriate for singing. And his point was, it was not really about the quality. It's about the willingness to take a risk and try something new and focus on those breathing techniques that you've talked about. And it was an amazing, enriching experience.
this has really been just fascinating watching and listening. A couple of things struck me. My father was a physician, and he was an ear, nose, and throat physician. He worked with a lot of deaf people. And he actually was a physician in Baltimore who helped remove a lot of deaf children from being labeled as mentally disabled. So he was a pioneer in that. I cannot sign. I wish I could. My sister can sign. She worked with my dad a lot. And I thought about this watching and listening to the three of you now. And I remember thinking this years ago, with Living Stage and with watching my father and sister work, that there's almost, because of deafness and watching people speak and signing, it feels as if there is a theatricalness that comes out anyway in nature of that, because it's physical in terms of how you speak. You know, people talk about Jews and Italians and black folks being physical when they speak, but there's something about deaf interaction that has that quality. Am I making too much of it?
Tim, I would say not. Willie, yeah, I think you're right. Tim, again, yeah, I think that's pretty spot on. Willie, when you see deaf actors on stage, they use the entire range. They use all three dimensions of the stage. Not to say that hearing actors don't, but hearing actors typically are very focused on producing the text verbally. David Hayes, the artistic director of the National Theater of the Deaf, he's one who has made that comparison between deaf and hearing actors and the focus and how it's different. Like, deaf people use the entire space that they have. Hearing people are much more focused on the verbal.
This is Tim. I remember an article being written about this very issue. And the sentence that you wrote said, hearing actors tend to fall in love with this hole, meaning the mouth hole. They want to sound a certain way, and the rest of the instrument, the rest of the body is dead. You know, they sound great.
Really, yeah, very true.
And this is Kara. So what I hear you saying is that maybe deaf actors, or really any actors who explore the physicality on stage, could have something to teach more traditional actors,
yes,
traditionally trained.
Willie, I absolutely think so. I have noticed that with hearing actors, when they're working with me, or even some deaf actors, when they're working with me, or when hearing actors are working with deaf actors for the first time, they feel enriched. They feel that they are given permission to use their physicality, to use the stage in a different way, to use their face more, and to act with their face and their facial expressions more than they ever have.
This is Tim, thinking back to working with Roundhouse Theater. We were developing a show. It's now actually in the repertory, based on Alice in Wonderland. So there were five or six of our actors, they were deaf, and five or six hearing actors. And part of the process of developing the show, you know, was developing the show, and part of the process was teaching the hearing actors to give them license, if you will, to use their face, to express them, mm-hmm, the lines through their body. And it was fascinating to watch their journey.
Kara.
Tim, I want to throw something out there about our experience in Quest. I was amazed, and there was a celebration of the senses, a performance of poetry. And we weren't really translating it into American Sign Language. We were making it visual, movement, gesture, and really playing with that language and figuring out how to translate that, so in a way that the audience would understand the feelings and the emotions. And it really doesn't matter if you're hearing or deaf at that point. That's taken out of the equation.
Tim, one amazing thing about that show is it's had a huge popularity in Europe. People ask for it all of the time. Are companies like rock stars in Europe? And here in America, people are like, Quest, who's that?
That was Tim McCarty, Artistic Director of Quest Visual Theater. You also heard Willie Connolly, deaf playwright, actor, and former chairperson for the Theater Arts Department at Gallaudet College. And Kara Miller, LGBTQA Resource Center Coordinator at Gallaudet University, who is also a clinical psychologist and an actor. You're listening to the World of the Play panel discussion I moderated last week at Everyman Theater in conjunction with their performance of Tribes. We're talking about finding a voice and ways we communicate. More of this fascinating conversation after this short break. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Let's get right back to the World of the Play panel discussion I moderated last weekend at Everyman Theater in conjunction with their performance Tribes. This discussion centered around finding a voice. And our guests were Willie Connolly, deaf playwright, actor, and former chairperson of the Theater Arts Department at Gallaudet College, Tim McCarty, Artistic Director of Quest Visual Theater, and Kara Miller, who is the LGBTQA Resource Center Coordinator at Gallaudet College and a clinical psychologist and an actress. Before we went to break, we spoke about Quest Visual Theater.
Describe Quest, because maybe people in this audience don't know what you meant when you said our work with Quest.
Tim. So Quest is a visual theater company. And it's akin to watching a film or watching television without the sound and still understanding what's going on. So it's very physical. The body is the primary tool of communication. We employ various circus skills. We do some mask work and puppetry as well. We use digital media in our productions. But we really focus on communicating in the visual mode. Our theater company is inclusive. We have deaf and hearing actors involved, which makes kind of all of our shows de facto accessible to all. It was started back in 2002. I was one of the producers for Deaf Way 2, a big celebration of the deaf community at Gallaudet University. And we had writing and film and musical elements and other kinds of art, and people were really taking off in all kinds of different directions, but theater seemed to have kind of maxed out at that point. And I remember asking Willie to come to a meeting in my office, and we sat down, and I said, why is this, Willie? Why have we hit this glass ceiling? And so the question that I really asked was, is the problem the words? Do people think of theater as words on paper? And then those words on paper are spoken in front of a hearing audience? So if words are the problem, why don't we get rid of them?
Wow.
And so visual theater was born. And it was also a way of creating jobs for deaf actors and deaf artists. But the interesting thing was that some of the funders told us that it wasn't about deaf people. It was about people who struggle with language, immigrants, for example. And when I thought about it, it really made sense, that divide that we talked about at the very beginning of this, just that essential divide. you know, when you are dealing with someone with a language other than yours. Statistics here in America show us that a lot of people don't have English as their first language, even if they're born here in the U.S. sometimes. And in D.C., 36% of the population has, you know, less than a basic understanding of the English language. That's not a small number, and these are not small numbers that we're talking about. So we began focusing more on deaf artists and giving them opportunities. But and in the end, it's really benefited everyone.
So you mentioned tribes and divides. I'd like to explore that for a moment. That within the play we saw, this play Tribes, there's this divide between hearing and deaf. There's also divides within the deaf world. And I think you described it in something I read, Kara, that an interview with you growing up in a hearing family, so you... Did I have that right? Yeah, right. And so you spoke,
right.
And you also knew how to sign. And then when you went into the larger deaf world, I guess it was in Gallaudet or wherever, but that was, you saw that divide between what world you came from and how you wanted to communicate and how people communicated. So I mean, I think I thought about that when it comes to one of the greatest divides in America, which is race. And even in the black community, there are all kinds of levels of divides. But then something happens when the gulf is met, the divides in black community mean less when they're facing the divide of racism in America and in the deaf community as well, I'm sure. You know, so I'm curious about what we learn from this in terms of what we can say to each other about this tribal world, this divide.
Well, I found the concept of family, language, identity, belonging fascinating. And there's so much that we could obviously unpack from this particular show. As somebody who grew up in a hearing family, you had that correct, I had a lot that I could relate to with this production. Not only because I was the only deaf person in a hearing family, but my family was very literate, very well read, very educated, intelligent. And they tried to... cultivate a sense of belonging in the family. And so that's obviously a difference from Billy, from this show. So I'm grateful to my family for having that sense of belonging. I always had that sense of belonging. I did communicate with my family using speech. I relied on lip reading, residual hearing with hearing aids. One difference is that my family was also willing to learn sign language. And not only sign language, but cued speech, which is another communication technique, another modality. And at the same time, I could really empathize with Billy, that feeling of that there's such a divide, there's them and me. And that came out for me mostly in group situations. Unfortunately, when I think about my family, you know, you think about family, you do think about group situations. Tim,
when you went to Gallaudet, did you feel that kind of hierarchy that they talk about?
Oh, I sure did. Sylvia describes that hierarchy in the community. And it's very real. We talk about it at Gallaudet. We talk about it at the cafeteria, where people sit in the cafeteria. So when you get into the cafeteria, and Willie, maybe you know, you'll add to this since you've been at Gallaudet for a long time as well, but there are clumps of students, and there are concentric circles of people sitting, eating, and talking. And in the middle, there's the deaf of deaf. That's what Sylvia talked about, the central most important people in the deaf community, those who have deaf family, who grew up signing, who are very comfortable in the deaf world, they are in the upper echelons. Then sort of the next circle out are people who are deaf, but maybe they didn't learn sign until a little bit later. Maybe their skills aren't, you know, native. And that would apply, for example, to me, you know, using other technologies, like I have a hearing dog, I use hearing aids. So that's sort of the next tier down. And then deaf people who don't sign at all. And they are really shunned from the community. So I absolutely found that hierarchy alive and well. I think often in the deaf community, we want to minimize the differences when we're talking to the hearing community, but it's there, and so I applaud the show for showing it.
This is Willie. Absolutely. I was thinking about my family while you were talking, and you mentioned that your family was a little bit more progressive than mine was, for example. My family was very slow to kind of catch up on these sorts of things. I identify as a deaf person, so I was really kind of attuned to what I needed. But it was really when I entered college that I started learning sign language. And that had an impact on my identity for sure, because as a child, I was put into a public school with hearing children. And this was really even before the kind of, this was in the dark ages, before the idea of mainstreaming really came about. But that was where I came from. And I remember, like, the family would invite extended family over, my aunts and uncles, for example, and I would just kind of roll my eyes and wait because I knew that conversation was going to be something I couldn't keep up with at the dinner table. So I would say things like, oh, I'm going to, you know, go sit in the kitchen at the kids' table, where at least I wouldn't be frustrated by that lack of communication. So the divide, the distance was certainly there. In very real ways. And, you know, there was some anger within me against my mother for not, you know, bearing my needs in mind, for not telling the whole family to accommodate me and what I needed. She wouldn't do it. And then when I graduated from RIT, I was signing, and I was talking about my deaf identity. And I started to see a change then at the dinner table, people being more attuned to what I needed, filling me in on the conversations that were going on around the table. And they stopped saying, oh, it's not important, or I'll tell you later. They did actually stop that at that point.
This is Kara. Something that I remember as well, that deaf is not the only identity that people have. We are multifaceted, and we are always negotiating those and navigating those different facets of our identity based on race, religion, class. We often see that, you know, that comes up as well in this this show, and there are other kinds of markers of identity. So I wanted to just add that. That's a complicated picture.
Region of the country.
Tim, and also which region of the country from which you hail?
Sure. Yeah, we don't like northerners, you remember.
Tim, right. There's you're from DC, you're from Gallaudet. Oh, that's a totally different world down there. We see that a lot.
So again, I'm thinking about what's happening here at Everyman and what's been instituted because of this play. And I think it's pretty profound what Vinny now wants to do here. So I'm curious about, I think this can in some ways push the envelope about the notion of the divide here and how it can be bridged. I don't make too much of it, but I think it's real. I mean, I think that we live in a culture where there are so many divides between us, deaf and hearing, obviously, but race and class and region, but race and class especially. And so I'm curious what you think us learning and struggling with and struggling around the deaf-hearing divide teaches the rest of us. And I think sometimes thinking about what might be happening in our theater can be part of that, you know, and is going to be part of that, whether it wants to or not.
Hmm. Wow.
This is Tim. Okay, so for me, I think it's important to find common ground, and that is never easy. It doesn't just happen. It requires effort. Building diverse and inclusive environments is always the goal and a noble endeavor. But it's hell in practice. You always have to get out there, make those human contacts. I know that Vinny wants to maintain very high aesthetic standards, but aesthetics can mean valuing diversity. And that's also been an interesting journey. But it's never easy. And it will never be easy. And that's the lesson that I've learned along the way. But I've also learned to enjoy the journey. I mean, if without that, I think life would be unchallenging and rather dull.
Anyone else?
Willie, I'm still kind of digesting the question, so I'll defer to Kara.
I don't want to make it sound trite, but we have many divides, and we have many everyday examples of people who are willing, brave enough to cross the bridge and to meet another group. We see that in Billy. We see that in Sylvia. We see that in everyday groups. At Gallaudet, where I am, even though we do have all of these different permutations of people in the cafeteria, people are still in the cafeteria together, brave enough to, you know, confront the situation, even if maybe it's a new situation for somebody. So I think we're fortunate to have theater to encourage us to see examples of that, to model ourselves after.
Willie, I'm also thankful for the ADA. That law has really helped lessen those divides, I think, between the hearing and the deaf worlds in particular, not only in theater, but in medical environments, in legal settings, and the like. There's a lot more porosity between those communities and a lot more interaction, and I think that can largely be attributed to the ADA.
I don't know if you all know this, but Everyman Theater is one of the first theaters in the country to use the captioning devices, so sort of case in point. And it was a remarkable experience. I had the experience recently, and for those who really, you know, want to know exactly what's happening in the English, what, you know, what people are saying, and being able to have access to that. And there were people who were sitting around me who were kind of peeking over my shoulder, you know, wondering what I was looking at. And they asked if I was recording the show, if I was doing, you know, and I was able to explain to the people around me who, when they left, these are people now who have a bit of education that they weren't coming to the theater to get necessarily. And I hope that that sort of education kind of spreads, you know, it's sort of the stone in the pond and the ripples keep going.
This is Tim. It's also a technical advance, which I think is great. But it's also part of social change, because now deaf and hard of hearing people can go to any performance here at Everyman that they want. They have that freedom of choice that was lacking before, and they can sit where they want in the theater. They don't have to sit in the deaf section or the deaf area. So this is a huge social shift. I think most productions offer one, maybe two signed performances. There are five signed performances or interpreted performances of Tribes here. So there's some freedom of choice there as well, but more than has been afforded deaf people before. Kara mentioned loving language and wanting to know exactly what the script has to say, and so that's a value and a benefit that she gets from that.
And I would say it's priceless.
But audience members like Kara want, you know, may want that English and the access to that, even though the interpreted performance is an art form unto its own right.
And this is Kara, just as a brief response to that. I think you can't put a price on that for me. It's really beyond value.
This is a lesson for all of us to listen to this, I think. I was also thinking about Quest Theater, that kind of physical theater, about other forms of theater that come out of the deaf community, and what it says to the hearing people to partake in that. But, you know, I mean, I haven't thought about that till this moment. You know, I've maybe seen one deaf performance in my whole life at Gallaudet many, 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 many years ago, though I did participate in a lot of physical theater. So it really makes me think about, you know, again, the divide and what we, hearing, even though I'm hard of hearing, hearing people miss. Do you know what I'm saying? And let me leave it there. What about the other end of that?
This is Willie. What that really makes me think of is about 20 years ago, I applied for a playwrights program at Yale University. It was an MFA program. And they had, I would say, about 300 applicants for that program. You had to submit a script. And from that, they narrowed it down to 7 candidates. I was called in for an interview with Stitt was the last name. The interview went back and forth. It was good. And then I got a letter from Yale that said, "We're sorry, we had to narrow it down to 4, and you didn't make the cut." And one of the reasons for that is you haven't yet found your voice. Which didn't sit well with me. Because the script that I had submitted involved a lot of sign language. I showed the letter to David Hayes, the artistic director at the National Theater for the Deaf, and we both just had this "what" moment. There are African Americans, there are gays and lesbians out there, and other kinds of playwrights who haven't found their voice yet either. And they were very interested in helping them find their voice. Why not help me? So really, what we need is that door open just a little bit to work on stage with deaf actors and hearing actors and to see that different perspective.
And this is Tim again talking about that continuum, really, of deaf people. There's deaf theater, there's signing theater, there's visual theater. I mean, we've talked about that.
Sure, why don't you take that, Tim?
I believe that everyone should have the opportunity to express themselves in their own natural cultural way. So I think we need to have deaf theater developed by deaf people, directed by deaf people, performed for deaf audiences in sign language. I'm all for it. And most people are used to signed theater, which is sort of a mixture. You know, National Theater of the Deaf, you may have heard of, deaf and hearing people are signing the lines. Deaf West, some of my work, some of your work at Gallaudet, where we have deaf actors. We call them, you know, hearing voice actors who are delivering the lines, so the show's accessible to both hearing and deaf audiences. And then further on the continuum, you know, this is where that Quest has chosen to explore, which is visual theater. And it's kind of that the shared area where hearing, you know, hearing people have their thing, deaf people have their thing, and then in the middle, there's something we all have access to, where we all live. So we hire hearing actors who don't sign. And we hire deaf actors who don't sign, as the case may be. I recently directed a show with 2 of our company actors. There were 2 actors from Austria and 1 from Latvia. And it's a visual show. So it worked well. You know, they watched the DVD, they could read the script, and we're going to do this show. And the hardest part was discussing the aesthetics of my directing approach, because I had to figure out what language to use. I'm working with people who don't have a language in common. So I've got, you know, American Sign Language with this person, or English with this person, German with this person, Austrian Sign Language with this person. So the problem really becomes the communication, you know, that happens off stage, but the work on stage is shared communication. And I really value every stop along that continuum. I think we can find places to support every kind of theater. This is Carrie. Yeah, Tim, I agree with you. And as the characters discuss in Tribes, we see, you know, the father is a writer and the son is struggling to write his thesis. And he's asking some really important questions. Does language create emotion? Does emotion cause language, you know, to happen? Which inspires which? And there are so many different forms of theater that we don't have to limit ourselves. There are so many ways for us to explore the question. It's a really exciting process and exciting prospect.
Willie Conley, Tim McCarty, Kara A. Miller, thank you all so much. It's been a great panel. Thank you all.
You just heard Willie Conley, deaf playwright, actor, and former chairperson of the Theater Arts Department at Gallaudet College. Tim McCarty, artistic director of Quest Visual Theater, and Kara Miller, the LGBTQA Resource Center coordinator at Gallaudet College. She's also a clinical psychologist and an actress. In a conversation around Everyman Theater's current performance, Tribes. For more information on our guests and on Tribes, visit everymantheater.org. And send us your feedback on today's shows at steinershow@gmail.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.